You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including new banded school board members, finalists for the Josephine County Commission, and an Oregon Supreme Court ruling's effect on public safety. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And Jane, you've been covering updates from the banded school district. First, give us some background on the situation there.
So there's been some disagreements in the district recently between some of the administration and the superintendent and teacher staff. Some parents are concerned. There's been a lot of turmoil. There have been teachers resigning. In the last couple of years, some other employees have resigned as well. Some of these people have accused the superintendent of misconduct. There's been a lot of complaints filed. There have been allegations thrown around against the board and the superintendent and various other people. The union says that the district hasn't been following their union contract. There was problems with contract negotiations last year. So it's been pretty divisive in what is a pretty small, you know, rural coastal district, but there's been some division there.
And what's new this week?
So the school board met on Monday, and they part of their meeting was considering three formal complaints that had been submitted, and those were complaints against the superintendent and the board, and they ended up dismissing all of them. One of them had alleged that the superintendent, Shauna Schmierer, had received what they called outsized and potentially fraudulent payments in her previous job as a superintendent at a school district in Washington. But they dismissed that. The board chair said that legal counsel had advised them that another district's finances are not within their scope. No banded school board policies were violated. The district's recent audits have all been clean, and so unanimously dismissed that complaint. And then they also dismissed two other complaints about a $5 million transfer of school funds and an allegation that the board improperly voted on a matter at a previous meeting. The board chair says that's not true. So basically dismissed all of these complaints, and then they also picked two new board members to fill some empty seats on the school board. Those were empty because two board members had recently resigned. One of them said that he had been targeted by people in the district, had people make allegations against him and his family, and said he had to put his family's safety first. So those, you know, two board members resigned. Now they've picked two new ones, so hopefully they can sort of move forward now.
Yeah, it sounds like a tough situation. What happens next?
So they now, as I said, have a full seven-member board once those two new people are sworn in, and they'll have some other complaints that have been forwarded to a private investigator for him to look into. I'm not sure the timeline on those, when we'll be hearing back on what his investigation shows. So those other complaints are sort of ongoing. And then there have been a couple of other complaints. There are a lot of complaints, those against board members of the superintendent that the board has said that they will consider at their upcoming March meeting once they have a full board. So we'll have to see what they do with those complaints at the March meeting, how they respond to those once they have everybody fully staffed on the board. And then later this month, also, the State Employment Relations Board is planning to hold a hearing regarding an unfair labor practices complaint that was filed by the union. So we'll keep following along with all of that.
Okay, of course. You've been following that so closely, Jane. Thanks for all your work on that. Roman, you brought us an update to the efforts to fill another two vacant seats, mm-hmm. This time on the three-person board of the Josephine County Commissioners. What happened this week?
Yeah, so there's this temporary board of the other elected officials in Josephine County that have been tasked with filling these two vacancies. Mm-hmm. So to bring people up to speed, just really quickly, that there's these two vacancies because two of the commissioners were recalled both in December and January. And so, you know, this board needs to do this themselves because there isn't a quorum on this three-person board of commissioners. There's only one person. So they put out a call for applications last week. They got 37 applications in total. And then out of those, they chose five finalists to interview. And then we also heard a little bit more about the logistics of the process, like they're going to be creating a list of questions to give out to all the people beforehand. And then they picked a tie-breaking protocol. And, you know, they're also going to require people to go through a background check before they get appointed.
Okay. Well, what can you tell us about the five finalists?
Yeah. So these were all of the applicants who essentially got the support of at least four of the board members. We have some people with governmental experience here. I'm going to run through all of them. The first is Colleen Martin. She's a real estate agent in Grants Pass, but was also the president of the Chamber of Commerce of Grants Pass in Josephine County and the chief of operations for the Oregon Chamber of Commerce. She was also a candidate for the Board of Commissioners back in 2024, and she ran against Chris Barnett and lost. And Chris Barnett was just recalled by voters, so she could be end up filling that seat after all. There's also Gary Richardson, who's a board member on the Grants Pass School District, and he's actually the longest serving board member there since 2005. We also have Simon Hare, who's the only former county commissioner on the list. Herman Bertschiger was also an applicant. He was a former commissioner, but he wasn't picked as a finalist. Hare was also the county budget officer after being the commissioner, but he quit last year. And he's also filed to run for county commissioner. He's currently the only candidate for position number two. He actually filed to run, and then he dropped out the same day, and then he refiled again a day later. So, you know. He
Some
might be
internal
he's candidate
drama.
Right now, but you know, maybe not tomorrow. Who knows? We also have Lorna Jesse, who works at the Josephine County Public Works Department. And I don't have a lot of information on her right now. And we also have Kirk Brust, who's a trial court administrator, who I also don't have a lot of information on, but his LinkedIn shows he was a regional manager for ODOT in the early 2000s. But that's kind of all I have about those two, at least.
And then just because I'm obsessed with the Olympics right now, this is like they've skated their short program, and next week it sounds like they're going to be doing interviews, and it'll be their free skate and the final choice, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're going to be doing their interviews and kind of their interviews will be happening in public next week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you mentioned in your story that Simon Hare, one of the former commissioners, also wrote a scathing letter criticizing the board. What happened there?
Yeah, so that letter was his resignation letter when he resigned as county budget officer in early 2025. He wrote this really long letter essentially alleging that the board is unqualified and some of the members are incompetent and can't do their job. Part of this was related to Andreas Bleck, who's the other recalled commissioner who was given authority to independently make hiring decisions at the county. And Hare accused Bleck of negotiating a multi-million dollar contract for the county operations manager, Michael Sellers, which would pay him a lot more than what was average for public servants, I think in the range of $300,000 something. He says he brought this up to the other commissioners, Barnett and Ron Smith, and they did nothing about it. And he says that the commissioners have just sort of swept things under the rug. And he called for all of the resignations, and you know, his wishes did end up coming true mostly because both Bleck and Barnett were eventually recalled.
And did the temporary board mention how they were scoring people, their criteria, or how they made these choices?
They didn't really. I mean, they didn't even mention the applicants by name. I had to file a public records request to get the names of the finalists from the county. They just said, I'm picking number 12, number 29, number 33. And I'm like, okay, great, cool. So, you know, the only person who did say something was Wally Hicks, who's the county council. He essentially said he only chose two people. The rest chose like five or six. But he said the two people he chose would be suited to face the challenges that lie ahead this year. And he said he wasn't looking for political motivation or business experience or strong-arm leaders. He said he was looking for people with government administration experience. But again, I don't know who he picked because he just gave numbers. So these appointees will also only be serving until the new commissioners are elected in November, I guess, really until January.
But, yeah.
So they're basically kind of caretakers for the rest of just this year.
So what happens next in all this?
Yeah, like I mentioned, those interviews are next week. The board's going to pick questions and decide the order on Tuesday. Then they'll interview the candidates on Wednesday publicly, make a decision on Thursday, and then their appointments will be contingent on a background check. And if they pass, they'll be appointed that following Monday. So, you know, the board's been without a functioning board of commissioners since Barnett resigned on the 26th of January. So, you know, they have a lot of work to do of 3 weeks of not being able to do anything.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that on next week's
debrief. Yes, we
will. Debrief. Justin, you reported on a recent Oregon Supreme Court ruling that will have a big impact on those unable to find a public defender. What was that decision?
Yeah, so this was a big decision. So the Supreme Court ruled that if a defendant spends enough time unrepresented, so unable to find a court-appointed lawyer, then their charges will be dropped. And, you know, the amount of time the defendant spends unrepresented before their charges are dropped, that depends on the crime. So 2 months for a misdemeanor and 3 months for a felony. This decision comes a couple years ago. The Supreme Court also ruled that a defendant can't spend more than a week in custody without a court-appointed lawyer. So after 7 days, they're released into the community. So this ruling really applies to people already out of jail, and it's really the latest decision in the state lawyers and politicians try to mitigate the effects of our public defender shortage. Oregon has been in a public defender crisis for years at this point, although counties like in Jackson County, I'll talk about, they've made progress. But right now, there's still around 2,500 defendants waiting on a lawyer in Oregon.
Wow, that's a lot. Well, what is this ruling? You mentioned Jackson County. What does this mean for our region?
So Jackson County actually has the third highest number of those currently without representation in the state. That's around 400, although those numbers fluctuate quite often. Douglas County actually has the fourth highest at nearly 200. And like I mentioned, Jackson County has improved this number. They've cut it in about by half in the last 2 years. I spoke with the Jackson County DA, Patrick Green, for this story. And he said because of this Supreme Court ruling, around 100 cases will be dropped this week. That's what he expects.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he also explained, the makeup of those unrepresented in Jackson County differs from, say, Washington County. And in Jackson County, the vast majority of those cases are misdemeanors, but still misdemeanors can include some pretty serious crimes like theft, assault, or DUIs.
But they're generally lesser than felonies, which are more serious.
Right, exactly.
Well, what does the Jackson County prosecutor think of the ruling and the effect it will have?
He's pretty critical. He acknowledges that this is an important issue. People shouldn't be waiting months for representation. This is actually a right we have. But he says this will have impacts on, alleged victims in these cases if the charges are dropped. And, for example, when a charge is dismissed, so are the pretrial conditions usually placed on a defendant for that charge. So in an assault case, that would mean a pretrial condition might mean no contact with the alleged victim. Or for a DUI case, it might mean no drinking or drug use. And those things will be dropped when the charges are dropped. He also said there are some questions he has about the decision, how it will be applied, which wasn't so clear in the ruling. So, for example, if someone fires their lawyer, can they have their charges dropped if they keep on, firing their public defender? And defendants could actually use this as a strategy in theory. There's also some limits on whether the county can refile charges after they've been dismissed. For example, charges can't be refiled for certain classes of misdemeanors or if the statute of limitations has run out. So, again, it's a hypothetical, but someone could be on the run for a certain amount of time and then, bring themselves in, be charged. And if they aren't appointed an attorney, those charges will be dropped. And because there's this statute of limitations, prosecutors couldn't recharge that defendant. So, it opens it up for some interesting strategies there.
Okay. Well, is there any way around this for prosecutors?
So the ruling does leave open the possibility for truly extraordinary circumstances in which a court does not need to drop charges, but it's unclear what those circumstances are. That will likely be clarified in some future litigation. So when a court dismisses a charge and a prosecutor challenges that dismissal. And so that, I'm sure, will come in the future, and we'll be waiting for that.
Okay, well, thank you, Justin. Rowan, you also brought us an update on the measles outbreak in Shasta County. It sounds like things have gotten a lot worse there.
Yeah, the number of cases jumped up from one they discovered last month to 8 total cases. Big jump, at least for measles. Right now, the state's reporting 17 total cases, so Shasta County has the most out of any other county. And, we're talking about measles specifically because measles is highly contagious. It's usually accompanied by a rash and flu-like symptoms and usually resolves on its own but can cause some serious complications, especially for children under 5. And measles is also technically considered to be eliminated in the U.S. Because of vaccination efforts that happened, but it's had this growing resurgence in the past decade because of anti-vaccination supporters. And, we've just been seeing measles come back and back in greater numbers.
So this has been a big jump, but The county doesn't believe it's a major threat to the public. Why is that?
Yeah, while it's highly contagious, all the people who were infected were close family or neighbors of the original patient, so they're not spread outside that group. And those people have been following county orders and isolating to prevent the spread. So it's right now it's not a major concern, but we could see more cases popping up if people, you know, came into contact with that first patient. You know, the county is basically saying, get the vaccine. You know, the MMR vaccine is 97% effective at preventing measles. Make sure you've gotten your vaccinations and contacting the county if you have measles symptoms.
Okay. Well, thank you, Roman. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.